Journey, journey, journey. It's so good to see some of y'all for the first time in a long time. Give yourselves a hand. So as you know, or I hope you know, this is like a startup within a startup. Like a startup business is really hard. Have you ever started a business? Raise your hand if you ever started a business. It's really hard. And so this thing is a church plant now in its 17th year. And this year, we've had two startups within the startup. Because on March the 15th, we were forced to start a new business of a sort. Still in the gospel business, but a different context and expression through live stream. And on June 21st, we started back up with bringing you to campus with all the accoutrements that nobody likes. But, you know, the text commands us to bear with one another in unity as we move into this startup. And so that was June 21st, the startup. And then we have this second startup today where we have kids back on campus in their appropriate places of learning. I think that's a huge A God. So for the entrepreneurs among you, which I are one, this has still been hard. But I want to encourage you or even challenge you to be a part of this particular startup, because this is a volunteer intensive startup. And there's a subset of our volunteers who were very faithful before we had to go to March 15th expression. And some of them are appropriately not ready yet to participate in their committed to assigned responsibilities. So we need some of y'all to say, I'm part of the body in this startup. And I will volunteer to help bring kids back on this campus and give the kids an opportunity to learn appropriately about the kingdom. So if you're not serving and you are here, I want to encourage you to sort of take the hill with us in this startup. I mean, really, the body of Christ is everyone with availability serving. Isn't that right? Isn't that the body? This isn't like a consumer-driven enterprise, is it, where we just come and receive, is it? So stand by for some more details about sort of a Take the Hill initiative between now and the end of the year. And we're going to give you a chance to engage in this most exciting, sometimes fraught with uncertainty, but always very interesting, phase two of reopen. And now, let's shift our attention, if we may, to weddings. Who loves weddings? And if you answered yes, and I've had as many of them as possible, then I enjoy them so much. I'm in it for the reception. Let's do it again. That's not where I'm going. But where I am going is an important text as part of Mark's recounting for us the life of Jesus in his roughly 3 years in public ministry. And we're in this particular story, Mark's story. You know, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John each have a story. There's some shared material and there's some unique material across each of the four. But they each have a story, a history, not a fantasy, but they each have a story of that same period of roughly 3 years of Jesus' public ministry. And we are walking through Mark's story, the shortest of the four. And here we are in week 7 and chapter 2. Which, for my money, ladies and gentlemen, who want to learn well and apply well, is the only way to walk through the biblical text in relevant, concise, connected, short sets of related passages or verses in order to glean. This I just was reminded of this I think this is appropriate. You can tell me if it is or not. Who's watched the reality show Alone? Anybody watching Alone? Oh, you should watch. It has many great lessons to teach us. It does. So Alone, you can find some of the seasons on Amazon and some on Netflix and some on the History Channel on demand. All right, so who's going to go check that out? It's not corrupt. It's not immoral. And if you say, oh, I'm out, then we have another conversation to have. But this is so appropriate to our understanding of how to dive into the Word. What happens is there's 10 people who are literally dropped into places like the remote reaches of Vancouver Island, where nobody has ever gone. And they're not dropped Bear Grylls style with a support team. They are dropped, and hence the name of the series. And they are taught how to do their own camera work with a variety of cameras and a variety of setups, and they must commit to record their journey at all the key increments, and even some just casual and unguarded. And what happens without exception, and Sherry and I just got finished watching the first series in the Arctic, Alone. And they always drop them in the middle of September. And you can imagine what happens in the middle of September forward as to conditions, both predatory animals and then food not available and weather unforgiving. And literally by day 30, if they're still left, I mean, there's accidents, there's just tapping out because of can't handle it emotionally. But from day 30 forward, you see these robust human beings so hungry that they are doing the happy dance over a mouse that was killed with a deadfall snare. And as you watch them eat, they have the smallest bones with the minutest particles of ligament and tissue that they are gleaning. This is the way we should approach the biblical text, because man shall not live by mouse alone, but by every word that is spoken from the mouth of God. And often we approach the text with this buffet thing that I'm just going to find something that looks good to me, and I'm going to have a cinnamon roll. But when it comes to the mousier, most necessary sinews and tissues of nourishing, life-giving, spiritual enrichment, we go, nah. So what happens when you approach the text like we are, verse by verse throughout the entire book, you can't avoid any of it. And it all is so life-giving because it's at first challenging and then convicting and then humbling. And then breaks us down to the realization of our humanity and the recognition of Jesus' superiority and divinity. I really like the way that came across. I might use that again. Did that make sense? So what we're doing now, we are in a small section of chapter 2, 5 verses, 18 through 22. Last week, we were in 13 to 17, another 5-verse section. And if you were here, or if you watched online, you know that that was a fulfilling meal in just 5 short verses, and we didn't even get the whole feast. And this section today is so critical, and so I opened describing what it means to think about weddings. How many of you had a wedding? And how many of you now have gone from that wedding into a marriage? Which is more important, a $50,000 extravagance to end all extravagances that impresses your family and friends that you're still paying for? Or a marriage that lasts in a satisfying, fulfilling way for decades? Which is more important? This is our conversation today in a very important context of what Jesus is offering as he arrives on the scene in the first century, given as a gift to his own people as a fulfillment of a promise made hundreds and hundreds of years before. And as always, there are crowds, and within the crowds there are leaders, and within the crowds there are the desperate and the hopeless. And each of them is forced to interact with Jesus' propositions and respond in their own ways. So here's a picture from my wedding. Isn't she beautiful? I'm not bad either, if I do say so myself. But. So this was October 30th of 1987. Lo, these many years ago, 33 years this October 30th. Wow. And if you're hand clapping, you should be saying, yay, God. Because apart from what Jesus offered, and it's very much embedded in this text today, this might have been the highlight. And not because of Sherry, but because of me. And today, we are going to be referred to as characters in this wedding narrative. And man, just get used to this idea. If you're someone who is a Christ follower, you are not the groom. You are the bride. And ladies, the bride's okay with you. Because we are, church, the bride of Christ, and he is the groom. And this is the introductory sequence that draws from Old Testament reality that Jesus now says in this text, I am this representative of the kingdom as groom. Now, he doesn't come out and say it. He does it as Jesus often does. He says it parabolically, puts it in an earthly story with a heavenly meaning. And there's, in these five verses, there are three different parables. And so just a quick review, we'll get into the text. This is what I call the third scandalizing confrontation with the religious leaders in the context of a crowd. Some in a synagogue, but mostly now we see out in the open. And a scandal is an event or a proposition or a package of content that causes an immediate default to outrage. And between chapter 2, verse 1, and chapters 3, verse 6, we're going to see four, if not five, depends on how you parse one of these conflicts, right one after another. And this is Mark's style. It's like a machine gun. Here it comes. Get ready immediately. And after this. And so we're forced to keep up. And so last week, the confrontation with the religious leaders was about feasting. Remember? Why does Jesus, the message from the Pharisees, the scribes who were Pharisees, to his disciples, why does your master eat with tax collectors and sinners? And Jesus pipes up and answers the question. This is who I'm here for. I'm here for people who know they're sinners. The desperate, the lost. The doctor is not to treat the healthy in their own mind. But he's here for sinners. And so Jesus, he's so subtly powerful. He is literally creating his own noose by God's design. By telling the truth about religiosity and dominant religious powerful oppression. And he's bringing a breath of fresh air to a group of people who have been suffocated religiously for centuries. And so last week in the feast, he answered, I'm feasting because they need me and they know it. For those who don't know it and think they're healthy and righteous, I'm not here for them. this week, it's not about feasting, but the other end of the spectrum, fasting. And so let's get right into the story. Mark 2, verse 18. And this could be the same event of the feast that Jesus said he was here for the sinners and the tax collectors and those who knew they needed him. But I don't think it is. Because we see here the Pharisees speaking directly to Jesus. In our last narrative, the Pharisees wouldn't approach Jesus because he was near the sinners. And they couldn't go anywhere near someone that dirty and flawed. Now, John's disciples and the Pharisees were fasting. Some people came and asked Jesus, how is it, here's the question, from feasting to fasting, how is it that John's disciples and the disciples of the Pharisees are fasting, but yours are not? There's only at this time, by the law of Moses, handed down first on Mount Sinai in Exodus chapter 20. That's the basis for the Old Testament. And then there were some developed laws from God that followed the Ten Commandments. That's what was handed down at Mount Sinai in Exodus chapter 20. That's the origin of the nation, culture, and religious practice of Israel. And then what followed from the mouth of God, delivered by Moses. But over the centuries, there was layer and layer and layer of man-made traditions added to that continued to provide a suffocating spiritual pillow to the oxygen flow of the people. And one of those categories was fasting. There was only one fast mandated in the law of Moses, and that was on the Day of Atonement. You know the Day of Atonement, Yom Kippur, the Day of Covering? And that was what I call the Super Bowl of external forgiveness. If the Super Bowl is so great, why do we have to do it again next year? Right? But Yom Kippur was that ceremonial symbolic day where a priest would slaughter a spotless lamb, take blood and sprinkle it onto the back of a spotless lamb, slap that lamb on the butt and send it into the woods as a scapegoat. That's where the word comes from. And that was the only day of fasting, that was the only season of fasting that was required, because it should be, right? I mean, hey, people, lament over your own sin. Deprive yourselves. Beg God for his forgiveness, external as it was. Like setting aside for a time. And I'm not going to get too deep theologically, but it's an important concept. All of these sins were set aside until Jesus came and cleansed the man from the inside out. But that was the only fast that was required. Well, over the centuries, the religious leaders had layered in at least another 20 mandated fasts by tradition. And Jesus is always railing against tradition, especially if it sets aside the word and command of God. And so the question is, from basic tradition, why is everybody else and not your disciples? See, John had his followers. Every rabbi, every teacher had disciples. John the Baptist, who introduced Jesus, still had a posse with him. The Pharisees had their disciples, those who wanted to be religious leaders, and they were fasting on these days. And so the religious leaders, always wanting to compile more for the portfolio against Jesus, wanted to slip this piece of paper in. He's violated the fast. And so Jesus now, in a way only Jesus does, he changes the category. And he doesn't just change it, he deepens it. He doesn't just deepen it, he deepens it and expands it to an understanding that those who will have ears to hear will recognize. And these are parabolic statements. Jesus says about parables, for those who have ears to hear, this is deep, rich, and powerful. But for those who don't listen, don't want to, this is just confirmation of a hard heart. And so he begins to paint a picture of a wedding. And he begins to cast himself in the role as the bridegroom. And he begins to say that as the bridegroom, I'm doing a new thing. You know he's doing it. God is doing a new thing. Remember? DC Talk, Toby Mac? Yo, who's doing it? Nobody? Just me? When I came to faith in 1991, now that was hot, y'all. That's just embedded in here. Toby Mac, DC Talk, you know, he's doing it. God is doing a new thing. But Jesus is saying in this narrative, as he develops his mission, this is unlike anything that, to the people who are listening, you've been suffocated with. And it's unlike anything that you, as the stifling religious community, insist on imposing on the people. And here's his answer in the form of a wedding. Jesus introduces the wedding as a new covenant relationship and as a new covenant relationship. You like what I did here? Who likes what I did here? You see the difference? It's a comma. So horizontally, we know biblically that marriage is a covenant relationship. It's not a contract. A contract says this. Now, I'm going to spend a minute here just to refresh our commitments to our marriages, please. This is not the primary point in this text, but it's an important one to at least pause at. You didn't say, I'll enter a contract with you. A contract says, if you perform this, I'll perform that. When you said yes before God, if you're a believer, when you said yes before God, you said, I'm all in regardless. And everybody said, oh, me. Now, some of you are going right to the exception. Okay, fine. You want me to grant you those? There are a couple of those. But let's not punt to the exception as a desire for a rule, shall we? So your marriage is a covenant. Just like God's every time we take the Lord's Supper together, we go right to the upper room, don't we? Where Jesus, after the bread, he holds up the cup and says, this is the blood of the new covenant. This is the blood of the covenant that I am bringing. And so what he's saying is, I have now, by grace, brought a covenant that can't be conditional. See, because Jesus' sacrifice, proven in his resurrection, says that everyone who comes to him will in no way be cast out. And so your marriage is a covenant. You're all in regardless. And I work this into my biblical marriage counseling. I work it into the ceremony, whether or not I'm allowed. I'm like, you people are at the table here. This is like Texas Hold'em, except you haven't seen anybody's cards yet, or even your own. And you're saying, I'm all in. You've already pushed all your chips in the middle of the table. And it doesn't matter what your cards are. You're all in, regardless. And everybody said. But the deeper understanding here is Jesus talking about what's been promised, even embedded in the Old Testament, is not the covenant of Moses and the Jewish law, but the new covenant. Understanding in the form of this wedding metaphor. And so Jesus punts right to here and he answers the question. Jesus answers with a question. How can the guests of the bridegroom fast while he is with them? And that's a rhetorical question, with the answer being, he can't. This is a party for now. They cannot so long as they have him with them. But the time will come when the bridegroom will be taken from them, and on that day they will fast. What is this foreshadowing? What is Jesus foreshadowing here? His arrest, his trial, his torture, his crucifixion, right? But now, it's a party. This is a new way to look at this thing. And so Jesus asks this question, and then he starts in the parabolic understanding. This parable is a heavenly story, one we all understand. We understand weddings, right? We think we understand weddings, but it's really important to understand what a wedding event looked like in Jesus' day and in the ancient Near East in general. He offers a parable now on new covenant marriage distinctiveness, and this is a suitable wardrobe. So, brides, how much attention did you put on your wedding dress? Like a ton. It was probably the most expensive item in your single item in your portfolio, right? For most of us. I don't know what Sherry paid for hers, but I wasn't responsible to pay anything then, so that's good. All I know is when my daughter got married, they told me to have a seat, and I had a seat. But Jesus is taking this wardrobe metaphor and not saying that you need to find an existing suitable set of clothes for this wedding event. There's something brand new going on. And this is how he cast it. No one sews. So let's just stop. Just about 45 seconds ago, and I've been explaining, but about 45 seconds ago, Jesus was asked a question. Why are your disciples not fasting? And look where we are now. What do you think the religious leaders are doing? What? Hey, who? No one sews a patch of unshrunk cloth on an old garment. Otherwise, the new piece will pull away from the old, making the tear worse. Now, this is where we in the 21st century, who are used to going to, where do you go for clothes?
Goodwill. I
don't know. Come on, boy.
I don't.
I love Goodwill. Y'all love Goodwill? I love it not because only I could find some cheap good stuff. It's like a treasure hunt. Like when I go into a department store, I just go over to the stacks and racks of everything's the same. But when I go to Goodwill, man, I just got to filter through everything on every bar. Like, whoa, look at that. I've scored. It's like finding a mouse on a loan on your deadfall trap. Look, it's in my snare. But we don't understand this. In the first century, a garment had to last and 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 last until there was nothing left and it was nothing but a bunch of patchwork, and even the patches were deteriorating. But what would happen is when you had a tear, you would get a patch and you would treat that patch first, because a new patch, just like 100% cotton, if you sewed it on to the breach, to the rip, and then washed it without shrinking that patch first, what would happen? That. But this is not what Jesus is saying. He's not saying, I'm here to be now shrunk so I can fit into your garment. He's not saying that. He's saying this is a new piece. This is a new understanding of what it means to do life with me in the kingdom. I'm going to give you a second with that. Jesus is not saying, I'm here so that you can make me a pre-shrunk piece and sew me into your system. That's not why I'm here. I'm here to be, you know, he's doing it. Yo, who's doing it? God is doing a new thing. So this is the first detailed understanding of this wedding wardrobe metaphor in this parable. He's talked about the bridegroom as the opening parable. And now he offers us this detailed understanding of the wardrobe and says, I will not be shrunk into your system. I'm here for a whole different reason. And this is the second detailed understanding under the main parable of the bridegroom. It's a wedding vessel. It's a wineskin. And again, we don't understand this. Before I read this, let me tell you what a wineskin is. A wineskin is lambskin. And a lamb is skinned. And it's turned inside out. The skin is turned inside out. So what was, remember Inside Out, boy? Who remembers Inside Out? Just me? What? Michelle does. So the lamb is skinned, it's turned inside out, and it's formed, if you just look at the basic form, and watching alone has really helped me on this, because they're skinning everything. And what happens is you start sewing it from the bottom, which is the bottom, and you start sewing it up to where the neck is, and what you have is you have this thing that's got this reservoir at the bottom, and it goes up into this neck at the top. And in there, in this new wineskin, you put wine not yet fermented. You put new wine. And so the flexibility of the skin, having just recently come off the lamb, allows the fermentation process, which releases gases, shrinks back, releases gases, shrinks back, releases, kind of like your husband or wife. Release, I don't know why I did that. It's kind of like, whoops. And so what happens over time is the wine ferments in this is the fermentation vessel. This is such a powerful picture for the New Testament church. This is such a powerful picture of what it means to allow stay with me here. This is biblical. The wine of God's Holy Spirit to put pressure on us, and we are willing to expand, and we are willing to go back, and we're willing to grow into this new understanding of the potency of God's life in us. But an old wineskin wants nothing to do with pressure, wants nothing to do with a necessary expansion, because what happens is it's already become firm and even brittle. And if you put new wine, there it is, and no one pours new wine into old wineskins. Otherwise, the wine will burst the skins, and both the wine and the wineskins will be ruined. No, they pour new wine into new wineskins. And so just now, a minute and a half ago, Jesus was being asked a question. And he has literally blown the categories of this narrow desire for either he recants and fits into their system, or they have another indictment to put into the portfolio. But they don't even know what to do with this conversation. All they know is we're escalating in our hostility because this guy is somebody we can't handle. Do you see the picture here? The wedding wardrobe, unlike any bit of wardrobe you've ever known, it won't be sewn into any understanding of life in the kingdom. So this is Jesus now giving us a new covenant understanding of wardrobe and wine. But if the Pharisees and religious leaders were honest, they would recognize what Jesus is saying. Jeremiah chapter 31 in the Old Testament. The book that the Pharisees use as a club, a hammer, a justification, a vindication. They are experts. Believe me, a subset or a larger set of these guys could recite from memory the entire text. This was written hundreds of years before Jesus now introducing this new thing. Jeremiah 31. The days are coming, declares the Lord, to Israel, when I will make a new covenant, not the covenant of the Mosaic law. When I will make a new covenant with the people of Israel and with the people of Judah. It will not be like the covenant I made with their ancestors when I took them by the hand to lead them out of Egypt, because they broke my covenant, though I was a husband to them. A husband to them. A husband to them. The Lord declares, this is the covenant I will make with the people of Israel after that time. I will put my law in. See, the Mosaic Law was an external code of moral obedience. And if you obey, says the covenant of the Mosaic Law, conditionally, God says, I will return blessing. Now, it's got a both and representation. We know, or we should know, as people made in the image of God, that when I live my life according to his moral compass, things go well for me. And everybody said. But also, this was in code. This is an external set of expectations. But we all know, or we should know, that this was not a law that brought salvation. We ought to know that the New Testament, especially Paul writing in Romans and Paul writing in Colossians, we understand that Jesus has erased the written code. All these sins that were temporarily externally set aside, he now provides the purification of in his death and provides an inward cleansing. So Jeremiah says of this new covenant, the Lord says through him, I will put my law in their minds and write it on their hearts. Interior, I will be their God and they will be my people. So these religious leaders, having, I bet, just already turned their ears off because Jesus, is that where we were? There we go. Jesus has now said what their law, through their prophets, already proclaimed. The prophecy is there's going to be a new way to do life. Every time we take the Lord's Supper, Jesus lifts the cup and says, this is the new covenant in my blood. So here's reliable biblical counsel for the new covenant wife. Remember, men, the bride. Me, us, the church. I got a couple of important takeaways here. Do you like this kind of stuff, where we go into the context and understand what happened? One thing I didn't tell you that's important, I think, is that when we do weddings in the West, we spend $50,000 and it's over by 3 or 4 a.m. the day of, or the next day, right? In the ancient Near East, a wedding looked like this. The bridegroom was this, I'm sorry, ladies. I may back up a bit. The bridegroom was the centerpiece because everyone was waiting for him to return from preparing a homestead for the bride. And they had some idea of when he may show up, and they might send a scout to go, how's the construction looking? Let's keep everything warm. But when the bridegroom showed up, this is powerful. Then the party would begin. And the exchange would take place, and then the consummation would take place. But they wouldn't go on a honeymoon. Sometimes the consummation would be after this celebration. Sometimes it would be before. It depends. You can see a variety of expressions in the Old Testament in some of the weddings. But these things would last for at least a week. It was a party. I mean, it was good. So my recommendation is, if you're going to spend $50,000 on a wedding, you better tell everybody it's going to last a week. And to bring more gifts. How about like Hanukkah, a gift for every day? Or maybe just cash to go against the 50 grand. So this is some reliable right now counsel for us, church, both in our vessel, holding the wine of God's Spirit, and in our wardrobe, taking off and putting on what's appropriate to life with a bridegroom. First, maintain a suitable vessel by consistent internal communion with the Spirit. This is what it means to be part of the bride. Imagine this. You know Runaway Bride? Julia Roberts, Richard Gere. So this is like this, but not really. In Runaway Bride, Julia Roberts has this history of going right up to the moment of the altar is like 10 feet, 20 feet away. And there's the husband to be, and there's the preacher, and there's the families, and there's the flower girls, and there's the attendants, and then she get cold feet, itchy feet, frantic feet, and leave. Imagine this: a bride walks to the aisle, goes down the aisle, stands before, makes the commitments, and immediately after the I do's and the pronouncement of man and wife, she vacates and spends little or no time with her groom for the balance of her life. Runaway bride. That's what I see as a tendency in a lot of believers, especially in cultures like ours where there's so many distractions. Is that we say, I do, I will, I am to Jesus, and then we leave. But that's not the expectation. And really, we're the ones who suffer the consequences. Because we've become attached and adulterers, really, to the other things we think are important in our lives. And we neglect the inner communion, the internal communion that he commands us to for our own benefit. He loves to hang out with us. My wife, and really, I'm just a dude. My wife, Sherry, is like consistently saying, I want to spend more time with you. I'm like, gosh, like I have like 3 minutes here. You want to? But that's not proper, is it? What I should be is the groom, and I'm getting better at this. She's less surprised, but when I started, she's really surprised. I'm like, okay, like every day I'm going to surprise her just by being with her. And you would go like, duh. But how is your time with the groom? If you're like most Western believers, I would say, and I'm optimistic, but if you're like most Western suburban believers, you're not really spending much time with the groom. What's interesting about that, and C.S. Lewis helps me here, why do I have a beautiful expectation of life forever with the groom if I'm not even interested in spending time with him now? Have you ever thought about it like that? But this is where it begins. A love relationship that he began with you by choosing you, by wooing you. The internal communion, life in his word, and communion with his spirit. And then from that dynamo comes behavior. So your behavior is never a substitute for communion. And I would offer, if you're not having communion, your behavior doesn't look like the life of the groom anyway. And everybody said, oh me. 2, maintain a suitable wardrobe through behavior which expresses the life of our groom. And I'm going to end. Go ahead. This is going to be a lengthy passage, but go ahead and stand. Come on up, Crossline. The best example I can give to this is something right out of a New Testament admonition and exhortation from Colossians chapter 3. I'm going to read literally about 15 verses. No, about 11 verses. And just listen. I'll probably prompt you anyway, but just listen for the wardrobe language, bride. Listen for the wardrobe language. And remember, this behavior is not what secures your identity in Christ. It's him wooing you to the I do. But when you run away from the altar, you're forfeiting so much benefit. Paul says to the church in Colossae, and therefore to the bride of Christ in Leander, Texas, here in this location, put to death, therefore, whatever belongs to your earthly nature. Sexual immorality, impurity, lust, evil, desires, and greed, which is idolatry, which is running after another mistress or mister. Because of these, the wrath of God is coming. You used to walk in these ways in the life you once lived, but now you must also rid yourselves of all such things as these: anger, rage, malice, slander, and filthy language from your lips. Do not lie to each other, since you have taken off your old self with its practices and have put on the new self, which is being renewed. That is the internal communion with God's Spirit, that inward renewal, which is being renewed in the knowledge of the... This is such beautiful wardrobe language. In the knowledge of the image of its creator. Verse 12, therefore, as God's chosen people, and everybody said, I mean, if you realize that you are one of God's chosen people, I mean, that's all you need in this world, because it promises the certainty of the vivid next. Therefore, as God's chosen people, holy and dearly loved, clothe yourselves with compassion, kindness, humility, gentleness, and patience. Bear with each other and forgive one another if any of you has a grievance against someone. This is the behavior expected from people who are living the life of inward communion and expressing the life of the groom. Forgive as the Lord forgave you. And here's your London fog spiritual overcoat. And over all these virtues, put on love, which binds them in perfect unity. You're a vessel with a wardrobe. Live a life worthy of the calling that you have received.